Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. You're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 18th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look and see what the weather forecast has in store for us today. Isolated showers possible with storm system today and tonight. A storm system that is generally lacking moisture will give us a slim chance for some light showers. This system passes through the region today, pushing a cold front through the area later this morning into the afternoon. This front carries the risk of isolated showers amid otherwise partly to mostly cloudy skies. A bit of a breeze from the southwest will be present ahead of it, eventually switching toward the west behind it. Expect a break behind the front from the risk of a shower before a few more rotate into the region this evening into tonight as the low pressure system passes by. A few more showers could linger into parts of Thursday too, especially early on. Of note, all of these shower chances in the next 24 to 36 hours are pretty slight. If you do experience some of them, rainfall amounts will be pretty light. Totals will be measured in just hundredths of an inch, or maybe around a tenth for a location that gets more than one shower. However, many areas will receive little to none at all. Just be prepared for the possibility of some raindrops affecting your day. Temperatures as the system passes through will vary a bit, likely reaching the mid-60s for most of today and limited to the upper 50s to low 60s on Thursday. We'll wrap up the work and school week with a really nice one on Friday as sunshine makes a return and winds turn a bit lighter. Highs into the mid-60s are likely again and will be a nice contrast for high school football fans compared to last Friday's rainy and cooler conditions. Winds could pick up a bit for Saturday, so consider that with your weekend plans. Temperatures will stay consistent on Saturday and Sunday in the upper 50s to low 60s. The following work week starts off on a pleasant note on Monday, too, with 60s for highs and at least some sunshine. Things will be more active from Tuesday next week onward to round out our 9-day forecast as the weather pattern changes and becomes more favorable for multiple chances for rain and some storms. While it's still several days away, the potential for substantial rainfall during this time frame appears to be increasing somewhat. Details, though, are a bit uncertain this far out, and things could certainly change in terms of timing, location, and intensity of various storm system features. It's something we'll be keeping an eye on and providing updates to as we get closer. This weather forecast was written by KCRG-TV. Now, turning to the front page of the Courier, Attorney General endorses Trump. Iowa boost comes as he pledges to deport terrorist sympathizers. Story written by Caleb McCullough and begins with a photograph of audience members as they cheer for former President Donald Trump during a campaign rally Monday in Clive. Dateline Edel. As former President Donald Trump rallied support in Iowa on Monday, some supporters at a stop in Edel said one major thing separates Trump from the Republican candidates that are challenging him for the nomination. Quote, he does what he says he's going to do, and that's what this country needs right now, said Cindy Beck of Emerson. Quote, we don't need a bunch of liars, unquote. Don Orban of Edel, who said he's going to support Trump in the caucuses, also said Trump's record as president and the perception that he followed through on his promises has won his support. Quote, I don't think anyone else has proven that they'll do what they say they're going to do, he said of Republicans challenging Trump. Quote, and I think Trump's not bought and paid for, unquote. Trump has visited the first-in-the-nation caucus state several times over last month to lock down his outsized support in an effort to score a major win in the January caucuses. Despite millions of dollars spent on advertising and aggressive ground games from his opponents, Trump has maintained a major lead over his opponents in Iowa for months, according to polling. A recent poll from the Iowa State University, conducted by Civics, found that Trump had support from 55% of Iowa Republicans. The next three candidates were Georgia Governor Ron DeSantis at 17%, former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley at 11%, and Vivek Ramaswamy at 5%. Despite the records of Trump's opponents as governors, senators, or businessmen, supporters said Trump has the clearest record of the kind of president he would be, because he's already been president. It's a record that, in the eyes of his supporters, was far superior to Democratic President Joe Biden's. Quote, "I think Trump is the only one that's going to turn anything around if we're not too late," Beck said. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd announced Monday she's endorsing Trump, welcoming him to the stage in Adel and Clive, and saying he would reverse a number of Biden policies she said hurt Iowans and Americans. Quote, "He will secure our border. He will fight the terrorists. He will fix the economy. He will stand up for agriculture. And he will hold up our Constitution and our way of life," Byrd said in Adel. The endorsement from the high-profile Republican is a major achievement for Trump, who leads the field in polling but has nabbed fewer endorsements from Iowa Republican legislators than Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. In Adel, Trump thanked Byrd and other legislators for their endorsement and said, quote, "People that don't endorse, we don't have them," unquote. Quote, "Now they're all calling," he said. "DeSanctimonious bombed," unquote. Trump has made public his displeasure that Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has not endorsed him in the primary. Reynolds has not endorsed any candidate, but she has joined DeSantis on a number of visits and has left open the possibility that she may endorse a candidate. At his rally in Clive, Trump said if reelected, he would reinstate and expand the travel ban he instituted early in his presidency, noting he would not accept refugees from Gaza, which the UN has said is a humanitarian crisis, as Israel has ordered more than 1 million people to leave the northern part of the enclave. Hamas, a militant organization in control of Gaza, launched an unprecedented sneak attack on Israel earlier this month, killing more than 1,000 civilians and taking hostages. Gazan officials say more than 2,500 people have been killed in Israel's retaliatory strikes. DeSantis has also called for rejecting refugees from Gaza. At a campaign event in Creston on Saturday, he said, "While not all Gaza residents are affiliated with Hamas, quote, they are all anti-Semitic and don't support Israel's right to exist." South Carolina U.S. Senator Tim Scott took a similar stance Monday that he would not accept refugees from Gaza because of difficulties in determining who poses a threat to the U.S. Trump said he would stand with Israel and claimed the attacks would not have happened if he were president. Trump also unveiled a new immigration policy on Monday, saying he would enact new restrictions in an effort to prevent Hamas supporters and other Islamist terrorist sympathizers from entering the country. Extending prohibitions beyond terrorism, Trump said he would institute an ideological screening on all immigrants entering the country. Trump said his administration would bar immigrants who support Islamist terrorists or Hamas, support abolishing Israel, and immigrants who are communist, Marxist, or fascist. In addition, Trump said he would undertake deportations of resident aliens with jihadist sympathies, and that he would revoke student visas for radical anti-American and anti-Semitic foreigners at colleges and universities. Quote, "We'll continue the process that I started in my first 4 years of stripping citizenship from criminals, terrorists, and immigration cheaters and frauds," he said. DeSantis said in the Creston visit that the Trump travel bans in 2017 targeted majority Muslim countries like Iran, Libya, Syria, and Yemen. The restrictions were challenged in court, but upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court by a slim majority. In a press conference on Monday, Iowa Democratic Representative Adam Zabner of Iowa City, who is Jewish and has family in Israel, criticized Trump's response to the attack on Israel and said Trump failed to support the Jewish community while president. He pointed to Trump's response to the 2017 anti-Semitic Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Trump's opponents have also criticized him for calling the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, quote, very smart, in a campaign event last week. Quote, Trump has consistently failed to denounce anti-Semitism. He has raised the platforms of white supremacists and neo-Nazis, Zabner said. Quote, now, as Israel is being attacked, Trump is airing personal grievances about Israeli leadership and has praised the terrorist group that attacked them, unquote. A federal judge on Monday issued a gag order on Trump in a case prosecuting his alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The order from Judge Tanya Kutkin says Trump cannot publicly target potential witnesses in the case, Special Counsel Jack Smith, his staff, or court personnel. Trump has attacked Smith in social media posts and on stage before, calling him deranged and a thug, and has targeted judges and their staff in criminal court cases. The four times indicted former president faces criminal charges in his alleged mishandling of classified documents, charges of business fraud over an alleged hush money payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels, and two separate cases over the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Trump skewered the gag order in his remarks on Monday. He said his opponents had weaponized the Justice Department and said he would appeal Chutkin's order. Quote, a judge gave a gag order today, did you hear that? Which, I believe, is totally unconstitutional, what she said, Trump said in Clive. Quote, the judge doesn't like me too much. Her whole life is not liking me, unquote. Iowa Republicans back Jim Jordan as defectors deny him the speaker's gavel. Story filed by Caleb McCullough. Dateline Des Moines. Iowa's all-Republican U.S. House delegation kept to the party line on Tuesday and voted for Representative Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, for Speaker of the House, even as 20 House Republicans voted for others in protest and denied him the gavel in his first bid for the position. Jordan, the far-right co-founder of the House Freedom Caucus, won the vast majority of Republican votes for Speaker in a vote on Tuesday, but lost 20 Republicans and was not able to reach the majority vote necessary to become Speaker. Democrats unanimously voted for House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, a Democrat from New York. Quote, I support Jim Jordan for Speaker, Representative Ashley Hinson, who represents Northeast Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, said on X. We spoke last week about our shared conservative priorities and the needs of Iowans, and I am confident he will advance both, unquote. The House will reconvene at 11 a.m. Eastern on Wednesday to hold another speaker vote. Jordan's defectors are largely moderate Republicans, some in Biden-leading district, who were reticent to support the conservative hardliner and Donald Trump ally. Without a change in rules, the House cannot pass any legislation or budget appropriations until a speaker is elected, and a stopgap funding bill passed last month will expire on November 17th. Hinson, Representative Marionette Miller Meeks of Iowa's 1st Congressional District, Representative Jack Nunn of the 3rd District, and Representative Randy Feenstra of the 4th District all voted to support Jordan on Tuesday. In an interview on Tuesday afternoon, Miller Meeks did not say whether she would vote for Jordan in subsequent rounds, but she said she wants Speaker Pro Tem Patrick McHenry, Republican from North Carolina, to bring the House back in session. Quote, Mr. Jordan did not have the votes, and going forward, people are asking what will happen, she said. Quote, certainly I think he is using this time to whip votes, but I joined a contingent of Republicans asking that the House immediately reopen, unquote. Miller Meeks said she had reservations about Jordan that included his past opposition to the farm bill and biofuel subsidies, as well as pressure tactics used by Jordan allies to whip votes. But she said those reservations were addressed and she honored her commitment to vote for the winner of the closed-door conference vote last week. Miller Meeks said she would not negotiate with Democrats for Speaker, but she said the House could pass a resolution to empower McHenry, who currently lacks significant power, to carry out House business. Miller Meeks faces a re-election challenge from former Democratic State Representative Christina Bohannon, and her district is seen as a competitive by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Quote, not shocking that Miller Meeks has fallen in line to vote for an election denier and man who spearheaded a national abortion ban, with no exceptions, Bohannon said on X, a man who opposed every farm bill that's come before him. Her agenda has nothing to do with governing or representing Iowans, unquote. Jordan was one of dozens of Republicans who rejected the 2020 election results from two states based on claims of fraud from Trump's campaign. The House Select Committee that investigated the January 6th insurrection said Jordan had conversations with Trump allies about delaying the vote leading up to the election. Quote, I voted to certify all the electors. That's where I am on the issue, Miller Meeks said when asked about Jordan's actions around January 6th. Quote, I do think that election integrity and voter integrity is very important, unquote. First-term Representative Nunn, who flipped his competitive district in 2022 and is also likely to face a tough re-election campaign, said Saturday he would support Jordan in order to get important work done in the House. Nunn said he was supporting Jordan to, quote, make sure we have a speaker who is committed to moving the important things forward that are happening in the world right now, unquote. Feenstra, whose Northwest Iowa district is the most heavily Republican in the state, said on X Monday night that he would support Jordan. Quote, I spoke to Representative Jim Jordan over the weekend and let him know that he has my support for Speaker, Feenstra said in a post. Quote, we must stop Biden's radical agenda, secure our border, and stand up for Israel, unquote. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart said in a news release Monday that a vote for Jordan as Speaker will harm Iowa's farmers and economy. Jordan has not voted for any farm bill, a major agriculture package passed every 5 years, during his time in Congress. Quote, with a looming shutdown and less than 3 months until Iowa farmers begin feeling the serious effects of the farm bill expiring, the next speaker needs to be someone who can work bipartisanly and legislate, something Jim Jordan has never done, Hart said in a written statement. Now for the crop report. Rain finally falls, but the timing is inopportune for farmers' fields. Dateline Des Moines. Iowa was cold and damp last week, with the northern two-thirds of the state receiving above-average precipitation, limiting days suitable for field work to 4.2 during the week ending Sunday, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Corn and soybean harvest continued to be the main field activities for the week, although there were some reports of fall tillage and dry fertilizer being applied. Quote, the widespread rain is definitely ill-timed, yet it's still badly needed, said Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagg. Though combines are sidelined and harvest progress is slowed, the rain will have a positive impact on recharging soil moisture, establishing cover crops, and replenishing pastures, unquote. A large and slow-moving low-pressure system spun several waves of showers and thunderstorms across Iowa during the reporting period. Stations across Iowa's northern half received more than a month's worth of rainfall. Temperatures were also lower where rain was present. The statewide average temperature was 50.2 degrees, 2.7 degrees below normal. Now let's turn to the sports page. The lead story is titled Magical Crossover. Iowa women have fabulous day at Kinnick in front of 55,646 fans. Dateline, Iowa City. And we begin with a photograph of the basketball court set up on top of the football field in Kinnick Stadium in Iowa City, and the crowd has packed the stands. The caption says, "Players transition down the court during the Iowa women's basketball team's exhibition game versus DePaul on Sunday at Kinnick Stadium in Iowa City. The Hawkeyes drew 55,646 fans, almost double the previous record attendance for a women's basketball game. The Iowa's coach came up with a plan for her team to play an outdoor game at Kinnick Stadium with the hope of setting an all-time women's basketball single-game attendance record. Iowa did that and more. The Hawkeyes' 94-72 exhibition win over DePaul in the crossover at Kinnick on Sunday drew 55,646 fans, almost doubling the previous record of 29,619 set by Connecticut and Oklahoma in 2002 NCAA championship game at San Antonio's Alamo Dome. Quote, "You know, you can have an idea and it could fall flat if nobody shows up," Bluder said. Quote, "But man, Hawk fans showed up today. 55,000. Breaking the record, getting to play outside. It was a dream. It really was. It was just fabulous," unquote. Quote, "55,000? That's pretty incredible," said Iowa guard Caitlin Clark, the reigning National Player of the Year, who put up a triple-double of 34 points, 11 rebounds, and 10 assists. Quote, "It's hard to kind of imagine yourself playing basketball in front of 55,000 people," unquote. Bluder's idea for an outdoor game came to her when 9,000 fans showed up for a campus celebration for the Hawkeyes in April upon return from their NCAA championship game against LSU. The game was played under partly cloudy skies with temperatures in the 50s and a gusty wind swirling around the north end zone where the court was set up. Quote, "Great weather," Bluder said. "It was raining all week, and then great weather today. I'm so thankful." The wind played havoc with some of the shots. The Hawkeyes were 36 of 73 from the field, but just 6 of 22 in three-pointers and 16 of 30 in free throws. Clark hit one of her familiar long-range three-pointers early in the second quarter, but she also airballed a free throw in the second half. Quote, "It was a little windy," Clark said. "The cold was perfectly fine. It was a bit chilly, and I'm glad we play an indoor sport. I promise I'll never airball a free throw again. The wind took that one for sure," unquote. The game was Iowa's answer to August's Volleyball Day in Nebraska, an outdoor doubleheader featuring the national power Nebraska Cornhuskers and three other in-state college teams that drew 92,003 to the Memorial Stadium in Lincoln for the highest documented attendance ever for a women's sporting event. Women's and girls' basketball has a long and rich history in Iowa. Girls played 6-on-6 high school basketball more than a century ago. Three offensive players, three defensive players, only two dribblers, and none allowed to cross half court. The girls' state tournament, first held in 1920, was a huge event televised statewide, and in neighboring states until the five-player game took over in the 1980s. Last year, the Hawkeyes ranked second nationally in attendance, and Iowa State was seventh. Quote, "We've had basketball here since the 1920s, Bluder said, noting that associate head coach Jan Jensen's grandmother is in the State Girls High School Hall of Fame. Quote, "I mean, this is deeply rooted in this state, so it's just perfect that it was here," unquote. Iowa forward Hannah Stolke, who grew up in nearby Cedar Rapids, said, "Breaking the record in our home city, my home state, is really amazing. I think it's just really cool being able to change the game and change people's mindset on basketball," unquote. Players and coaches from both teams also participated with the crowd in the wave, the tradition of fans at Kinnick waving to young patients and their families who are watching games through the windows at the adjacent Stead Family Children's Hospital. Proceeds from the game are being directed to the hospital. A check for $250,000 was presented during a break in the game. Among the attendees were former Iowa players Megan Gustafson, the 2019 National Player of the Year, and Kathleen Doyle, the 2020 Big Ten Player of the Year. Quote, "Before that game, I just talked to them about this being a historic day for us," Bluder said. "How we were playing for more than just ourselves, playing for the university, fighting for the children's hospital. We just talked about playing for everybody else and not for ourselves," unquote. Bluder's team has never been more popular in the state. The program is coming off its best season. Clark is the returning Associated Press Player of the Year and a showwoman with her deep three-pointers. Every home game this season is a sellout. Quote, "It's really hard to wrap your head around everything that's happening," Clark said. "Obviously, you can imagine it, but it's never the same until you're actually in the experience, enjoying it and loving it," unquote. Now, on the hockey ice, huge second period lifts Hawks to victory. Waterloo wins both weekend games. Story written by Jim Nelson. Dateline, Waterloo. For the second straight night, the Waterloo Blackhawks exploded for 4 goals as Waterloo won its United States Hockey League home opener 4-3 Saturday at Young Arena. Friday night, Waterloo scored 4 times in the second in a 5-2 win over Chicago. The back-to-back victories came after a rough weekend in Sioux City and Sioux Falls last weekend and improved the Blackhawks to 3-4-0. Being at home helped spark Saturday's win. Quote, "There's nothing really like this place," defenseman man Jaden Kerr said. "Small building, low ceiling, tin roof. Nothing like playing in front of the Party Town crowd. The energy is amazing. I love playing here," unquote. Waterloo head coach Matt Smabby, who was celebrating his birthday, said the results were good, but a lot of work is still left to do. Quote, "The results were good," Smabby said. "Incremental improvement from last week to where we are at now. But there's plenty to fix and plenty to work on. But finding a way to win when you didn't play your best can't change your focus on getting better." Teddy Townsend's first USHL goal, 3:31 into the first on assists from Landon Nikes and Jaden Kerr, gave Waterloo the early lead. After Omaha tied it on a Alski Kivoja goal, the Blackhawks erupted for 3 goals, 2 of them special teams tallies. Adam Zilkna's 4th of the season came on the power play as Gavin Thorson and Grady Deering assisted. Deering put a shot on the net, and the puck bounced to Zilkna, who slammed it home with 8:53 left. With 4:37 remaining in the period, Jacob Altrecher scored shorthanded, the second straight night Waterloo has scored shorthanded. Finally, John Mustard made it 4-1 on assists from Alrecker and Thorson. Quote, "It is good to see them to go in Smabby said. We got to find to sustain a little bit more offense and sustain the job. If you look at our third period, we have given up some bigger leads and let teams back into games, unquote. Quote, I think coach would like a little more spread out scoring. We knew we had to have a bit better second period, so we committed to the work and the results showed, Kerr said. That was the case in the third again, as Omaha, which scored late in the second to cut its deficit to 4-2, scored with 13 minutes 29 left to make it a one-goal game. The Lancers continued to push and had a couple of prime opportunities to tie after pulling their goal with just under 2 minutes left, but Waterloo netminder Calvin Vacon held strong and finished the night with 30 saves. Quote, I think our puck play was just average, Smabby said. We ended up feeding their offense with our puck decisions at times. Our awareness away from the puck, I think there's a lot to clean up, a lot of little things. Quote, but points are important. Every point is important for us. I think we got to enjoy it a little bit, but be honest with ourselves and where we are at and how much work we have to do. Waterloo is back home Friday when Lincoln comes to Young Arena. And now, listeners, we just want to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 18th, and you're listening on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial comes from the Storm Lake Times pilot, editor Art Cullen. God is not governor. The explosions in the interminable war between the Abrahamic religions in the Middle East illustrates what happens when clerics and zealots control governments and militias. Lord only knows where the war between Israel and Hamas, and by extension, Iran and Hezbollah, will lead. Probably to more war and death of innocents all around. Yet here we are in the land of the free, imposing religious doctrine on women and doctors, school boards and library boards, and of course the military, and granting special favors to preachers, tax exemptions, to churches and their disciples, tuition vouchers to religious schools. Ron DeSantis is building an Iowa political strategy around pandering to evangelical voters. In Storm Lake, he was sure to visit Cornerstone for Life. Tim Scott is running TV ads about his religious beliefs, while, in his own lying way, claimed that President Biden is complicit with Hamas in the attack on Israel. In Iowa, know-nothings are trying to ban books from the library and classrooms across the state. Families with gay children are fleeing for Minnesota. White people claim a special birthright in trying to drive out and keep out Latinos. Take it far enough, and it gives you the right to send in troops to Mexico. That's why the founders, while giving thanks to their own version of God, Jefferson did not have the same idea about it as Adams, deliberately set up a secular government, not owing to any king or creed, but self-determination of the people. Those patriots had a belly full of the king and the Church of England. Hindus in India and Muslims in Pakistan have nuclear arms pointed at each other. Putin mustered the Russian Orthodox Church to bless the attack on Ukraine. The Sunnis in Saudi Arabia hate the Shia in Iran. We all pray for God to be on our side in the war as children are bombed. Here in the United States, we are blessed indeed by the wisdom of the founders and the durability of the Constitution to protect the minority from oppression. But when you hear the nonsense from DeSantis or Scott masquerading as religious righteousness, it makes you queasy for freedom. All sorts of bad things, even horrors, are committed in the name of the Lord. The Bible and the Quran are not legislative guides. the Ayatollahs and the Pope know next to nothing about marginal tax rates. Anytime you hear someone talking about how their faith inspires them to hold you down, beware and find someone else to support. Next, from the New York Times, President Biden's Finest Hour, written by Brett Stevens. This column doesn't always abound with praise for President Biden and his administration. This week is an exception. On October 8th, the day after the greatest atrocity in Jewish history since Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen, Jews in Israel and the diaspora woke up without a leader. The Prime Minister of Israel has never been, in a formal sense, the leader of the Jews, even when the office was held by people far worthier than Benjamin Netanyahu. But the Prime Minister does have the most important job in the Jewish world, which is to ensure that Israel be a safe haven for Jewish life. The Jewish people have long memories. Whatever happens next, Netanyahu will be remembered irrevocably as the man who failed, not tragically, much less heroically, but selfishly, arrogantly, despicably. He maintains political authority, but is devoid of moral authority. I cannot imagine a future for him or his cabinet of blowhards and toadies, except in exile, walled compounds, or prison cells. Biden stepped into the vacuum. I have read, probably a half dozen times now, his October 10th speech about the massacres. For its moral clarity, emotional force, and political directness, it deserves a place in any anthology of great American rhetoric. Without equivocation, without the mealy-mouthed cliches and evasions that typified so many institutional statements about the assault, the president said what Jews desperately needed to hear, that the massacres were pure, unadulterated evil, that there is no excuse for what Hamas did, that Israel has an affirmative duty to defend itself, not simply a passive right, that the United States will make good on its commitment to a Jewish state, not with feeble statements of solidarity, but with the surge of military force. A few days later, in an interview with 60 Minutes, he called the assault barbarism that is as consequential as the Holocaust, unquote. We need political leaders who maintain the capacity to call out barbarism by name and who commit themselves to its defeat. We need it especially on the political left, certain corners of which waited only a few days before returning to their usual program of denouncing Israel for its alleged or anticipated war crimes. These are the same people who sometimes pretend to believe in Israel's right to self-defense, but offer no plausible strategy for how Israel can exercise it against a terrorist enemy that hides behind civilians. We also need Biden's leadership, given the moral void on the right. I spent the years of Donald Trump's presidency being hectored by a certain type of Jewish conservative who insisted that Israel had never had a better friend in the White House. Today, Trump takes a dimmer view of Netanyahu, less because of his failed performance than because he can't forgive the prime minister for calling Biden in 2020 to congratulate him on his victory. 4 days after the Hamas attacks, Trump also called Hezbollah without reprobation, quote, very smart. About Vladimir Putin, he said, quote, I got along with him very good, unquote. Very good, very smart. The Republican frontrunner. Now Biden is going to Israel. It's a brave trip, even for a president with his vast security apparatus, given that Hamas's rockets continue to fall indiscriminately on Israel for a second front with Hezbollah could open at any time. He is going, almost surely, to do what he does best, console the bereaved and bereft, give courage to those in fear. This is statesmanship in the teeth of far-left opposition and insistent right-wing criticism. The president's finest hour. I have seen some criticism that the hidden purpose of the trip is for Biden to hug Israel close so that he can stay its hand, or at least slow it. I doubt it, since he could hardly have been clearer in his 60 Minutes interview that Hamas would have to be eliminated entirely, even as there needed to be a path to a Palestinian state. That path is a long one, but Biden gets the big thing right. The former is the basic precondition for the latter. No Israeli leader can ever allow a Palestinian state to exist if a group like Hamas has even the whisper of a chance of gaining power. I expect Biden to caution Israel's war cabinet that a military campaign that concludes with a long-term Israeli occupation of Gaza would be a pyrrhic victory. I expect the Israelis to reply that they cannot be asked to eliminate Hamas as Gaza's dominant military and political actor without the cooperation of the United States and moderate Arab regimes, particularly Egypt. This is not a confrontation. It's a potentially fruitful dialogue that will work much better once Netanyahu is out of office and cannot put his personal needs ahead of the national interest. I also hope that Biden's leadership can remind the decent left and what's left of a decent right of what American moral leadership looks like, to stand with our allies and hold our friends, to see our enemies for what they are and treat them accordingly, to remind ourselves that as others see us, so should we, as the last best hope of earth. Now from the Des Moines Register, written by Jamie Renfro, we have expand temporary workers programs to support the economy and the rule of law. The subhead says, market-oriented solutions recognize the principle of supply and demand within the immigration context. They acknowledge that immigrants will continue to seek opportunities where they exist. Now to the editorial. In the ongoing immigration policy debate, finding common ground remains a challenge. Immigration is a multifaceted issue involving economic, social, and humanitarian considerations. While discussions often revolve around border security and immigrant entitlements, there's a pragmatic alternative that deserves attention: harnessing market-based solutions to address immigration challenges. Immigration debates frequently center on the costs and benefits of immigration to U.S. citizens. Critics argue that the costs of the current immigration system imposes a burden on taxpayers and strains available resources. While those concerns are valid, it's equally important to recognize that immigrants, whether documented or not, play a significant role in the U.S. economy and society. Striking a balance that respects the rule of law while harnessing immigrants' economic potential is essential. Market-based solutions provide a path to strike this delicate balance, leveraging supply and demand principles in immigration management. Expanding temporary worker programs is one such market-driven solution. Here's how. Temporary worker programs address labor shortages in industries like agriculture, hospitality, and construction. These sectors often experience fluctuations in labor demand throughout the year. Temporary worker programs allow employers to fill short-term gaps by hiring foreign workers when needed, aligning with the market principle of efficiently matching labor supply with demand. Economic contributions. Temporary workers directly contribute to the economy by filling essential roles and supporting businesses. Employers pay competitive wages, reflecting market-driven compensation, and these workers spend their earnings in local communities, stimulating economic activity. Flexibility for employers. Market-based temporary worker programs offer employers flexibility to adjust their workforce according to market conditions. When demand rises, they can hire more temporary workers. When it falls, they can reduce their workforce accordingly, a crucial aspect of market-driven solutions. minimized incentives for unauthorized labor. By providing legal avenues for employers to hire temporary workers, these programs reduce incentives for individuals to engage in unauthorized or illegal employment. This aligns with market principles by regulating the labor market and discouraging illegal labor practices. Market competition. Temporary worker programs introduce labor market competition, prompting businesses to improve working conditions and offer competitive wages to attract and retain skilled temporary workers. This competition mirrors market-driven dynamics. Crucially, market-oriented solutions recognize the principle of supply and demand within the immigration context. They acknowledge that immigrants will continue to seek opportunities where they exist. If job opportunities abound, immigrants are more likely to come, but if these opportunities dwindle, their incentives to migrate decreases naturally, reducing immigration numbers. This approach doesn't advocate for open borders or a disregard for the rule of law. Instead, it underscores the idea that immigrants, when provided opportunities to contribute their skills and talents, strengthen the nation's economic foundation. Moreover, addressing immigrant benefits shouldn't solely focus on cost-cutting measures. It should consider how immigrants can become net contributors to society. By leveraging their potential, immigrants can boost economic growth, create jobs, and enrich the cultural fabric of our nation. A market-driven approach to immigration, grounded in supply and demand dynamics, can help bridge the divide in the immigration debate, particularly appealing to conservatives. It acknowledges immigrants' vital contributions while upholding the rule of law and ensuring that benefits are earned through economic participation. Embracing market solutions, we can create an immigration system that fosters prosperity, innovation, and utility, while upholding our nation's defining principles. Next, from the New York Times contributor Charles M. Blow, titled, "Do Early RSV Vaccine Trials Have a Henrietta Lacks Story?" Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, is a nasty bug. It's the leading cause of hospitalizations among American infants and results in thousands of deaths among the elderly each year. So earlier this year, after the Food and Drug Administration approved two vaccines for adults 60 and up, approved antibodies for babies and toddlers, and approved a vaccine for pregnant individuals to protect newborns, the new capacity to effectively deal with RSV was hailed as a medical breakthrough, and it is. The new vaccines have been thoroughly tested in accordance with today's clinical trial standards. But this breakthrough has a history, one tangled up in questions of medical ethics and racial exploitation. A fascinating report published this week in UNDARC, a nonprofit digital magazine affiliated with MIT, I'm a member of the magazine's advisory board, found that in the 1960s, some of the first and youngest subjects to receive experimental shots in a clinical trial of early attempts to develop RSV vaccines were Black and poor children, some in foster care. And though questions remain about what parents knew, quote, archival documents hosted at the NIH suggest that parents did not give informed consent, or in some cases, any consent at all, for their children to receive the largely untested shot, unquote. According to UNDARC's reporting, it appears that for some of those children, rather than offering protection from the virus, an early experimental vaccine worsened it. Two Black children in the trial died, just one day apart, as the new year dawned in 1967, both in the same Washington, D.C. hospital, both little boys, neither living to see his second birthday. That was the way America was, adding that the children who were given the experimental vaccine were probably thought of as disposable. Indeed, the reporter, Mr. Scholson, who became interested in RSV vaccine research last year after his own son was hospitalized with the virus, told me that what surprised him most during his work on the story was the relative lack of surprise that family members expressed to him when they learned about how an experimental vaccine most likely played a role in how two children died. That lack of surprise is the scar tissue that Black Americans have built up, the knowledge that the worst is always possible. The mind and spirit continued to make space for it, forever hoping, but preparing contingency for hope's inevitable betrayal. We have learned this from history. UNDARC's reporting about Victor and Ross calls to mind infamous cases of racism in the American medical establishment, such as the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, which treated Black people as disposable, and Henrietta Lacks, who was treated as dehumanized tissue. But as is often the case, the question comes down to the issues of justice, reparations, and restoration. What are the families of the children involved in those experiments, particularly the families of Victor and Ross, now owed? UNDARC reported that Victor's family members recalled the family receiving a modest payment after his death, quote, funeral expenses plus $1,000, around $9,000 today, adjusting for inflation. This year alone, sales of the new RSV vaccine are expected to be in the billions of dollars. And how should the country make this right with these families? And how many more tragic and complicated stories are out there waiting to be discovered and told? As Mr. Scholson said, quote, I'm sure there are many more stories just like this one, unquote. Now let's return to local news from The Courier. Salvation Army assistance registration closes Friday. Those in need of Christmas assistance are invited to complete an online application accessible at www.saangeltree.org. All applications must be complete with supporting documents uploaded by Friday, October 20th. As with previous years, applicants should be prepared to upload supporting documents, including photo identification in the form of a state-issued ID, proof of income, and birth certificates for all children registered. In place of birth certificates, we will accept school registrations or immunization records that display the child's name and date of birth. Registration is limited to residents of Black Hawk County. Families may register children ages newborn to age 17. Applicants who need assistance completing the application may call the Salvation Army at area code 319-235-9358 to schedule an appointment with Salvation Army staff and volunteers. Next, we have iconic sculpture damaged by wind in recent storm, set for repairs. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. And the story begins with a photograph of the Song Sung Blue sculpture in Waterloo, which is a large blue guitar with the neck now bent from the storm damage. The sculpture is on the promenade at the River Loop Amphitheater in downtown Waterloo, Iowa. Dateline Waterloo. Plans are in place to restore an iconic downtown sculpture that was damaged in a recent storm. High winds last week bent the neck of Song Sung Blue, the blue iron guitar on the promenade at the River Loop Amphitheater. The artwork is now surrounded by caution tape. Quote, we are currently lining up the logistics of moving it, said Connie Page, interim director and curator for the Waterloo Center for the Arts. The plans are to relocate the Song Sung Blue to the University of Northern Iowa's Public Art Incubator in Cedar Falls. There, it will have its neck straightened and receive other maintenance work before returning to the River Loop area, Page said. Quote, it is loved by many, so we want to get it restored, he said. It is definitely a destination and an icon, unquote. The sculpture had needed some restoration work, with more than a decade of wind and rain taking its toll, Page said. The need became more apparent last week when a storm moved through town, causing vibrations to twist the metal. Artist Jerry Cowger, a Waverly native, now living in Waterloo, created Song Sung Blue around 2008, and it was first installed at UNI's campus on the Kemmerich Art Building Plaza. It was moved to Waterloo in 2012 as part of the River Loop Plaza and Amphitheater project. Waterloo main flushing continues. Story written by Courier staff. Dateline Waterloo. The Waterloo Waterworks will continue its water main flushing program on October 19th. The water mains in the area of Dysart Road from Shawless Road to East Orange Road and Dysart Road to Applewood Drive will be flushed. Customers living within the area and within several blocks of the flushing area could experience some discoloration in their water. Customers are urged not to plan a wash day on October 19th. The discolored water is bacterially safe. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 18th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.